You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Great. Well, good morning to all of you. Thank you so much for coming. I'm Karim Sajidpour from the Carnegie Endowment, and it's a pleasure to welcome you on behalf of not only the Carnegie Endowment, but also the Brookings Institute and the Woodrow Wilson Center. And we've been wanting to do a conference for a very long time on the issue of democracy and human rights in Iran. Those issues are oftentimes drowned out by the nuclear issue. And this has been a wonderful occasion in that Mehran Gizkar, who is our dear friend who had been affiliated with the Brookings Institute and the Woodrow Wilson Center, we were looking to somehow celebrate the life and the legacy of her late husband, Siam Akbar Zand. So we have a wonderful program for you all morning, which will commence now, looking at the legacy and the life of Siam Akbar Zand. And then we have subsequent panels, which hopefully you have before you on your schedule. But I wanted to quickly hand it over to, and if you can please turn off your cell phones. I wanted to hand it over to Mehran Giz and her family, first to Leyli Pourzand, who has come from Canada, and to her husband, Mehrdad Hariri, and also to Mehran Giz. And then at 9:30, hopefully, we'll commence the panel. So thank you. Please, Leyli.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for having us today. It's a great pleasure for all of us. Before I start, I just want to say my sister, my younger sister, Azadeh, is missed today, and she lives temporarily in India, and she passed her warmest regard to everybody. The passage that I'm going to read is a short passage about the life that I went through with my father and different points of life that I was faced with his possibility of death. Two things that I need to mention is when I'm reading Baba it means father or daddy in Farsi, and John is dear. So, and we were calling my dad Baba John, and normally he was calling us not with the name. He was calling us Baba John too, or with the name Leyli John. Friday, April 29, 2011, at 7 o'clock my time and 2:30 p.m. his time. I talked to him 3 hours before, and he assured me that he's doing well. I dialed the familiar phone number in Tehran again and expected to hear his warm voice to say, Baba John, why you don't sleep? Why you are having broken sleep? I told you I'm good. Go to sleep, Baba John. But a stranger's voice on the other side of the line shocked me. Who are you? I'm Leyli from Canada. Who is Leyli? I'm Siamak's daughter. Oh, what do you mean? Nothing. He's not alive anymore. He died about 2 hours ago. I was screaming. What are you talking about? I talked to him 3 hours ago. How would it be possible? Yeah. And he threw himself from his balcony 2 hours ago, and he died. The sharp voice reached my body, and the pain remained there until now, and the pain is even more settled. I remember 33 years ago in 1997, when I was only three, and a few weeks after the Islamic Revolution, I went to his office in Kehan newspaper with him. When we got there, his secretary ran to him and said, you need to run away. They are here in your office, and they want to throw you from the window of your office to the street. One of those revolutionary executions. You know what I mean, Mr. Pourzand. Leave Leyli with me, and I will take her home. Run away. I looked up to his face, and I told him, Baba John, I don't want them to throw you from the window. I want you alive. He hugged me, kissed me, and told me, Baba John, I promise you that I don't let anybody to throw me from any window, and smiled. I haven't seen him for a few months after that, and he has an underground life for a while. It was a late night in 1998, and he was so nervous. I was 4 years old at that time, and our lives, like millions other Iranian, was upside down. He was depressed, and he took me out for a walk to the street. He said, "Babajan, have this piece of paper with you and keep it safe. And if anybody came and took me away with himself, or if you can't find me anymore on the street, just pass it on to the police officer." I asked him why I should keep it, and he said, "Maybe somebody take me and I never come back." And I said, "I don't want you to go away." And he said, "Babajan, I promise that I will stay with you." Later, I learned that his brother, my uncle, was leaving Iran illegally at the same night, and he was so nervous because of him. In April 1986, I was 11 years old, and Azadeh was 1 year old. He was in Evin prison. It was sunset when the home phone rang. He said, "Salam, Babajun." I got excited and said, Babajun, where are you? When are you coming back home?" Baba passed on the phone to your mom. And I said, "She's not home." A silence, and then he told somebody else on the other side of the line that, "My wife is not home. I cannot say this to my daughter." Somebody else from the other side of the phone said, "I told you, tell her. Anybody, I don't care, tell her." Babajan, these gentlemen are kind, but they forced me to call and tell you I'm going to be executed tomorrow morning. I'm on a death row. Please pass on this message to your mom and stay strong. Okay? I promise that I come to visit you from sky. Keep strong and pass on the message to your mom." And silence. In 1987, Tehran was under missiles from Iraq, and my parents decided to send me to a safe place north of Iran. He was driving me to that city, and he told me, "Let's enjoy the view. Maybe we never have the same chance again to drive this road again." I asked him why. He said, "Because we are going to send you to a safe place, and we are going back to Tehran. And, you know, missiles is there, so maybe we are one of those." I said, "Babajan, I want to come back with you." And he said, "Well, keep us strong. In 1995, chain murders began in Iran, which targeted writers and activists. We were ready to be faced with any tragic situation every single moment. He was driving me to the law school that I was studying at that time and said, "Babajan, you are a grown-up woman now. I want to make sure that if anything happened to your mom or me, you need to keep strong and take care of your sister. And also, now you are a woman and you have a responsibility that we couldn't for our dream that which didn't come true." It was 2000. I lived in Toronto at that time. My mother was in Evin prison. I called our home in Tehran. Baba said, "Babajan, we finally could visit your mom. She was so weak but strong. We need you to keep strong over there and don't think about us. Okay?" Okay. It was 2001, and my mother was released from on the bail from Evin prison and survived an aggressive cancer. And she lived Iran with temporary permission and lived in Washington, D.C. to continue her treatments. My father was kidnapped a few months back, and my phone rang in the middle of the night. It was an April night that the phone rang, and a broken voice said, "Babajan, consider me dead. Don't do interview with media. I'm dead." Okay? A background voice ordered him, "Hang up, stop, hang up." He said, "Babajan, I'm dead. Do you understand? Pass on this message to your mom too. Please don't do anything for me. Please, these gentlemen are really nice, but you don't do anything. I'm dead, consider me dead." And said, "Babajan, And somebody else on the other side said, hang up, hang up. I told you, hang up. And said, please, one more second. Leylijan, Babajan, and silence. In 2009, he was in house arrest. And I sent him a secret message that I arranged for you to leave Iran illegally. And I will be at the other side of the border to get you and take you to Canada or US. Just a few days after, he sent me a secret message and said, I'm not going to leave my own land at the age of 78 like a criminal. I will stay here and will wait on if I am alive, I'm waiting for justice. If I am not, this is your responsibility to ask for justice for me. April 29, 2011. It was not his voice anymore who was delivering the familiar message of death to me. It was a stranger. A stranger's voice said he threw himself from the balcony. The same apartment that he lived there for 7 years of his house arrest. He was right. He did not let anybody else to throw him from any balcony, but he threw himself from the balcony. I hung up the phone and ran to our balcony in Toronto. I could see him down on the ground, laying down, relaxed, with a smile on his face. I wanted to go to him, but I remember I have to deliver this message to Azadeh and my mom. I didn't want him to hear the news from media. I looked down again and heard his voice. Babajan, I'm free now. Baba, you have to keep strong. And you take care of yourself. Don't forget that you and Azadeh have a responsibility. It's your time now. Finally, I'm free. And yes, he's free.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Mehrtad Hariri. I am the son-in-law of Burzand family. First, I would like to thank Carnegie Foundation for this, for organizing this event, and everybody who worked in this organization, those who organized this panel. Special thanks to Karim for putting this fabulous program together. I'm sure Siamak Burzand is here today with us, and very happy and content to see this group of young journalists are getting together and discussing human rights and democracy in Iran. Because this very notion, bringing young journalists together, was at the core of his activities prior to his imprisonment. One of his fascinating skills was bringing together the younger and older generation of journalists and artists in Iran, and putting them together and let them mingling and provide opportunities for younger artists to grow and to show themselves and to showcase their art. This is especially important in the context of Iran, a society that has a lot of gaps in it, and one of those, a very big one, the gap between the young and the older generation. So his work was very much needed. At the same time, that kind of work considered a political act, and he was risking his life by doing so. Siamak was the man of foundation. He founded several institutions. He founded the first cinema club in Iran. He founded the first union of newspapers writers in Iran. He founded the first magazine dedicated to movie and cinema industry. He was the first Iranian reporter to Hollywood. He was the founder of numerous other national foundations, including the summer camp for students, who became very popular and famous in Iran, because he was the one who knew the most popular artists and used to take them to that summer camp. So everybody in Iran knew about that camp. Excuse me. The programs were broadcast on the national TV because they were so popular, and that only one man could do this, and that was Siamak, because he was well-regarded, respected among artists, and he had extended links with younger generation. Compared to his long career, almost half a century as a journalist, I witnessed only a snapshot. My communication with him was limited only to phone conversations. Mutual feeling and love was remarkably instantly started. Deep love. And which lasted forever. I considered myself as a lucky one who could feel his love and his passion. He was a human being with extraordinary passion for his country, with so much love for his family, so much love to give to everybody. You could sense it with the first conversation, and I was the lucky one who could sense it. I'm happy to be here. Once again, thank you very much, Carnegie Foundation, for becoming pioneer in this remembrance ceremony for a remarkable individual who has very special place in his country, in the history of Iran, for his service to his country and achievements in the field of journalism, for his love for human being, for his big heart and his passion. Thank you very much.
Hello, salam to all you. Before anything else, allow me to express. Thank you. My deep gratitude for your participation in today's seminar held in the honor of the beloved husband, Siamak Purzand, whose first year anniversary of a tragic suicide is fast approaching. Also, in particular, I would like to take a moment to thank Carnegie Endowment for Peace, Brookings Institution Seven Center, and Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars for having organized such an extraordinary event to celebrate the legacy of Siamak and many others alike who sacrificed their freedom and life for a brighter future in Iran. My family and I are in particular and very appreciate to the unconditional, continuous, and heartfelt efforts of individuals at these organizations to set my husband free to help us bring him to the United States so that he could reunite with me and his beloved daughters after 10 years of persecution, solitary confinement, imprisonment, torture, and house arrest. Among them, I would like to name Karim Sajjadpour, Susan Melanie, Stephen Grant, Hollis Fandiari, Mehran Etebari, and others. Sadly, we did not succeed in bringing Siamak abroad in time for him to see his daughters, friends, and colleagues. I so wish Siamak could have been sitting among us today. If this were the case, he would have been the first to get up in front of this esteemed audience and remind us that he was just one of many to undergo such brutal injustice for his commitment to freedom of expression and democratic values in Iran and beyond. He was not alone in this case. I recall vividly his trembling voice during the days of the Green Movement, when peace had completely left his body and soul, as he could not stand hearing about young, beautiful, bright, and hopeful young protesters detained, beaten, and shot to death. All he would say to me on the phone was, why, Mehri? Why, Mehrijan? Why should they go through this? Why? I could feel despair and yet hope in his voice all throughout the years that he suffered under house arrest in Iran, forcibly separated from his daughters. He had adopted the young generation of Iran as his own daughters and sons, whose youth he was frightened was being wasted in the name of the expediency of the Islamic Republic. By throwing himself from the sixth floor balcony of his apartment on April 29, 2011, Siamak left his daughters and I in the dreadful nightmare of his tragic loss. In the past year, his daughters and I have had trouble to reconcile with Siamak's tragic death. Now, we are left without him. We miss his presence in our life, his love, our lengthy phone conversations with him, during which he would inquire about every single detail of our lives here on the other side of the world, his hopeful words, and his unique appreciation for life. Yet, we have had to accept that Siamak does not only belong to us anymore. In the past year, we had been blessed by the love and sympathy of many who are deeply inspired by Siamak's art of life and Siamak's art of death, and by this true struggle against repression. Let me end by reminding all of us once again of those who, like Siamak, currently suffer in the prisons of the Islamic Republic of Iran for simply having peacefully defended freedom of expression in their homeland. Let us honor them and their struggle. I am forever grateful for all that you all have done for my family and for the freedom of a nation. Let us continue with our struggle for a better and brighter and peaceful for future of Iran. Thank you.
Thank you. And so the first panel will be on culture and human rights, moderated by Hale Esfandiari.
Good morning. I'm Hale Esfandiari. I run the Middle East program at the Wilson Center. I would like to add my voice to the family and thank Karim Sajjadpour for really putting a lot of effort in putting together this meeting. The idea came from Susan Maloney a year ago when she contacted both of us and said, maybe we should do that, have this program honoring Siamak Purzand and discuss human rights issues in Iran. And we both jumped at this suggestion, but I think it took us a whole year to put together this meeting, but better today than not doing it at all. I think except the family, I don't know how many more people are in the audience who knew Siamak. I knew him. We were colleagues at Keihan. And I think I remember the first day I saw him, he walked into a big, the editorial room of Keihan where we were all sitting there, and there was this young man who walked in, tall, dashing, and very sort of self. I said dashing, yeah, self-assured. You know, walked in, and I turned around to one of my colleagues on the foreign news desk, and I said, "Who is this person?" And he said, "Don't you know him? He's Siamak Purzand." And I said, "No, I don't know him." He said, "Okay, I'll tell you who he is." So over the years, I saw Siamak as long as I was a journalist, on and off, at the paper. And then after the revolution, when I would go to Tehran and visit this colleague, he would always keep me up to date of what Siamak was doing. He was in touch with him, and he remains nameless because he still is in Iran. So must confess that last night, my husband and I, Shaul Bakhash, who also was in Keihan, but Keihan International, we were exchanging memories about Siamak. When did you see him the first time? When did you see him the first time? Anyway, I think what you left out, the family, was he had also a sense of humor. You know, he would, when we would come in the editorial room of Keihan, you would, wherever he went, you would hear some laughter. So he must have told people something funny that sort of also brought them to laugh. And that was, I thought, one of his strong characteristics. It's an honor to be here, to be part of this group. But now back to the real business. I have asked, our panel is going to deal with culture and human rights. And I don't think my panelists need introductions. You have their bios. Mehrangiz Kar is the most prominent woman lawyer, activist, human rights activist, and a prolific writer. We go back to pre-revolutionary time in Iran. And as I was coming to this meeting, I recalled the conversation I had after the revolution with Mehri, trying to figure out what was going on. And she said, "You know, when I was a student at Tehran University, the day they built a mosque on campus, I knew that the culture has changed." I don't know whether you recall that conversation. So that's something we will touch upon later. I mean, culture, religion, and human rights. Omid Memorian, I met him after the revolution. He is a victim of human rights abuse. There is the lawyer. This is the victim. And but they could not break him in jail, which was wonderful. He came out as forceful as he went in, and he has been an activist writing about human rights abuse in Iran. And again, I met him in a number of coffee shops in Tehran. We would meet there with, and he would bring some of his colleagues, and we would talk about various issues. And finally, Roberto Toscano, who was the former ambassador of Italy to Iran. I think I met him in Iran once, but I had heard about him. There was a legend that he was always there to help human rights victims. So, and I must tell you an anecdote. In prison, one of the questions I was asked was that, "Do you know Roberto Toscano?" And luckily, I didn't know him. So I said, no, I met him once, which was the truth. And they left it at that because I knew that, had I known him, that would have created another week of questioning, focusing on Roberto. So our arrangement with this panel is that each of my panelists will have 7 minutes of opening remarks. And I say 7 minutes, and I'm going to watch
this. This is the first time I'm hearing that 7 minutes, yeah. Not 10, not 5. And this is Holly.
And then I will ask a couple of questions, and we will open the floor to your questions, preferably no comments from the audience, just questions. Mehri?
Okay.
You can sit.
I guess 1 minute is past now. I would like to talk about cinema and censorship in Iran, something that is Siamak like that. And always she was working for artists in cinema and giving them better situation and better possibilities during Shah, and then after Shah during Islamic Republic. And now I became so sad when I was heard that Iran won Oscar this year. And it was really a sad time for me because Siamak was not alive, because Siamak was working for that all the time. And this is something that, I became sad after that. So we can say Iranian cinema recently won the Oscar, posing a question in the minds of many along the world. How did Iranian artists manage to create such amazing arts that is now celebrated in the world? How did they do so, despite heavy censorship? I can talk about this question and analyze the situation that Iranian artists are working on that. Arts creation is naturally in contradiction with ideological censorship. The creative mind cannot produce original and timeless arts if confined in an ideological prison. This is a general rule that explains the necessity of freedom of expression for arts, creation, and artists. Strikingly, Iran is an exceptional country in which strict ideological and religious censorship and oppression have done wonders to creative arts. In other words, Iranian creative arts have in many ways exceeded expectations and have succeeded to communicate important message beyond the limitations of censorship. In fact, Iranian artists have often left many international festivals and societies of arts for creating exceptional arts despite all the restrictions of the extremist Islamic school. This school is on power in Iran right now, and the culture of this school says the first and the last word in Iran for artists and all people who are working in creative fields. Nevertheless, Iranian artists have had to pay a high price for achieving such a level of international respect and prominence. Throughout its political history, Iran has never experienced an extensively free environment in which artists could work without the fear of governmental conditions and provisions. However, the life of the artists who had managed to find a way to promote their arts during the Pahlavi era worsened after the Islamic Republic of 1979, when the ideological elimination of artists began. As a result, many of these artists had to stay at home and refrain from promoting their arts, were exiled and detained. Ultimately, whether in Iran or exiled, Iranian artists faced poverty, isolation, and oppression in the aftermath of the Islamic Revolution. It is remarkable now Iranian artists have not only tolerated ideological censorship in the past 33 years, but also have managed to find ways around it. While some of the artists and especially filmmakers of the pre-revolution era had to adjust themselves to the new ways of censorship imposed in the Islamic Republic, the rest of the younger artists grew up and were educated in the midst of ideological censorship. And yet both groups of artists managed to challenge the foundation of values and cultural principles behind such a censorship through their arts. Among these artists and filmmakers, there are many women who have played an important role as film and theater directors, actresses, designers, authors, poets, and other fields of arts, and have expressed their objections against anti-women policies of the Islamic Republic. This is while their art is so delicately done that it even manages to pass some of the toughest measurements of censorship. As such, we cannot ignore the role of artists and especially female artists in shaping the mentality of Iranian youth who now bravely stand up for their rights, claim their cultural and historical heritage and freedom. Despite the tough days of the present time, Iranian artists and filmmakers have succeeded in teaching the world an important lesson, and that is creative arts, if done cleverly, is sufficiently powerful to reverse the impact of censorships. This is how Iranian artists have continuously broken the silence that the political system has imposed on them for years. And it was coming from rich culture of that society.
Thank you very much, Mehri.
8 minutes.
No, it was 7 minutes.
I was like that. Thank
you. Okay. Thanks, Susan, Karim, and Halejun for having me here.
Thank you.
Over the course of past few years, we have witnessed a number of positive trends that, in my opinion, are indicative of a cultural shift regarding how people think about human rights in Iran, at least amongst the Iranian civil society. This cultural shift, exemplified by certain emerging trends, is drawing a new map of the significance of human rights in Iran's political and cultural discourse. Simply put, cultural changes in Iranian civil society are making it difficult for the Iranian government to ignore human rights violations in Iran and abroad. One major trend amongst Iranians has been a marked rise in discussing issues that are perceived as taboo, especially using the discourse of human rights. For example, despite the Iranian government's ongoing propaganda against people of the Baha'i faith and its efforts to make any connection to this community a security issue, the topic of Baha'is has come to the surface of human rights discussions in Iran. Even during the 2009 presidential elections, one of the presidential candidates directly addressed the issue of rights for Baha'is. I believe two major incidents have contributed to these discussions. One was when Nobel Prize winner lawyer Shirin Ebadi took on the case of arrested Baha'i leaders. Even though it created a storm of attacks against her, It also laid the groundwork for public discussion, at least in the online community. The second incident involved the activities of students expelled from universities, young people who were denied higher education because of their political activities or their religious beliefs. These students who fought side by side for their rights highlighted their situation and highlighted the situation of Baha'is in Iran more than ever. The sympathy and attention toward this issue was so significant that Javad Larijani, the Iranian government's representative to the UN Human Rights Council last year, he publicly denied that Baha'is face any discrimination in Iran, telling the council that Baha'is all have access to education, are not barred from business, and so on. This mere acknowledgement was already a reflection of how much the public discourse around Baha'i has shifted. Another issue that Iranians are starting to talk about, at least in the online community, in the Iranian civil society, among like activists, academics, students, is gay rights. This has been slowly entering Iranian civil society discourse as a right-related issue, even though culturally it's still on the extreme end of social discussions. For example, in an infamous speech in 2007, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad claimed that Iran had no homosexuals. Now, however, partially as a result of increased gay rights discourse, Iran has slowly begun to acknowledge homosexuality. Granted, it's not always in the best context. For example, in the criteria for military service in Iran, which just recently came out, there is now an article dismissing gays from military service. But the fact of the matter is that the Iranian government is now acknowledging the existence of gay people, something it did not do less than like 5 years ago. Another major trend I've seen over the past few years is the public outreach of political prisoners, even from inside Iran's prisons, mainly through the only medium available to them, which is letters, writing letters. Over the course of past two decades, dozens of political prisoners have written critical letters to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. In these letters, families that have explained human rights violations against themselves or against their families or colleagues, we see that after the 2009 election, we have seen a kind of rise in writing these letters. And by journalists, by activists, by political dissidents, and so. Political prisoners have also been writing letters to the public from inside Iran's prisons, which is very unprecedented in such scale. In these letters, they call out the government for the human rights violations committed against them, and Iranian authorities have had a lot of trouble digesting these unprecedented actions, and the consistency and determination of the government's critics has led to a higher level of public awareness of the human rights situation. These letters create a buzz on the internet, and they are being distributed through many different outlets, including broadcast and satellite networks like BBC Persian and Voice of America, which are present here now. And this publicity has been an instrumental factor in challenging the regime's narrative regarding the current political situation and its denial of human rights violations both in Iran and outside. Also, I can add, as romantic as it may sound, the publication of love letters between political prisoners and their spouses has greatly impacted human rights discourse in the country. Even though love letters from prison have existed since,
the first day, probably.
Yes, it has been forever. The public expression of prisoners' deepest feelings has added an element of humanity and emotion to the plight of these prisoners of conscience. The publication of their letters, even if only parts, has served to shed light on their situation in a way that humanizes them to the public. And there are other trends that, I think I might go out of time, but there is definitely more to this argument. But I believe The trends I mentioned here indicate an ongoing struggle between the state and the Iranian civil society in human rights battlefield. In the interactions between the Iranian government and civil society, including dissidents and those who have been targeted by the government, we see a new kind of spirit. Iranian civil society is using diverse methods to highlight human rights issues, give voice to the voiceless, address previously taboo issues, and most importantly, make the human rights situation in Iran something its government cannot longer ignore. If Iran's human rights situation is being highlighted in many different ways, it's because of a series of actions and interactions, forceful initiatives, and emerging cultural trends that has made Iran's human rights situation very important thing. I think I addressed most of the things I wanted to mention, and we can discuss the rest during the Q&A. Thank you, Hale.
Thank you. You know, the master of ceremony is standing there and he keeps on looking at his watch, so I have to make sure we are on time. Roberto.
Well, when Hale is running the show, there is no problem in knowing when your time is over. The link between human rights and culture is, to me, evident. But unfortunately for many people, too many people, when you talk about human rights, you focus about political rights, which, of course, is important. But culture has a very, very special, very deep link to human rights, and especially in a country like Iran. Cultural freedom has two sides. First, you have the right to have access to cultural products. And second, you have the right to produce culture. So you have the right as a producer of culture, as a consumer of culture. And the regimes, non-democratic regimes, trying to infringe on both aspects. The case of Iran is a very, very special. Because whereas in many countries, non-democratic countries, regimes try to block the flow of culture, the Iranian regime is in a contradiction. For two reasons. First of all, it's in a contradiction because the cultural heritage of Iran is such that no regime, not even this regime, can afford denying it. What they do is they try to appropriate it in a very ambiguous way, in a very contradictory way. And the second is the link between culture and education. Education has progressed in the country quantitatively. The best thing for a regime would be to have people, a regime like the Iranian one, people highly educated, but prevented from having access to free culture. But this contradiction cannot be resolved. A population like the Iranian population cannot be kept down culturally. And you see the contradictions. We're talking about cinema. You know, people in this country who have seen A Separation say, how is it possible? A film like that made in Iran? Yes. Because there are certain skills by those who produce culture. I remember some friends told me, you know, once you present a draft for a script, let's say, you put something really outrageous in there. And so you're sure that the censor will focus on that and will not notice what you really want. This is one. And then, of course, not everything succeeds in that. One of the things that I enjoyed most when I was ambassador in Iran was being the owner of a movie theater inside the residence. We had a projection room, and we were showing Italian films, of course, that was my job, and Iranian films that are not shown in Iran, which justifies some of the suspicions that were that I raised in the regime. Although I never did anything subversive, but that's subversive enough. So for the regime, culture is, on the one hand, something that they cannot really confront too openly. Besides, they love it when an Iranian film wins prizes abroad. The best thing would be to win prize abroad and not be shown inside. Great. But on the other hand, they fear why? Not because artists produce ideological creations against the regime. You know, that if you have put ideology in your artistic creation, it's bad politics and bad art. I mean, think of what socialist realism was, you know, that really. But even if you do not do that consciously, if you talk about real people, real problem, real issues, that is already subversive. And regimes don't really know how to handle that, luckily. And in Iran, this is especially the case. Because whoever is familiar, unfortunately, to my shame, I never learned the language, so I don't have access, direct access to the literature. But as far as films are concerned, this it was my main contact with Iranian society. And what comes out is something that surprises the world. People who have seen a separation say, oh, I thought that Iran was Pasdaran, Chador, and nuclear issue. Well, there's something else, isn't there? And that something else allows people to know the richness of the country, but also puts the government, the regime, in a very difficult situation. There have been fluctuations. There have been moments of more repression, moments of less repression. The regime, of course, only wants to survive, and sometimes it thinks that in order to survive, can open up a little more. Then it gets scared and becomes more repressive. The game is always the same, but the stages are different. In the meantime, what I think we should do is express all our solidarity to people who still manage to produce good culture even in those conditions. It would be unfair, and although unfortunately sometimes it happens, that to say that if you stay in the country and work in the country and produce culture in the country, you have to accept some compromises. Therefore, I don't accept and I don't value your production. This is not fair. It's not useful. Some people go out, and so, of course, they are free to say everything they want. But even if you are honest, you cannot say everything, but whatever you say is honest. That is good for the people who have to live there. You have to. I remember I had 5 years in the Soviet Union in the 1970s, and we had a friend who was writing about Italian culture, and she said, I have to be very prudent, but I don't want to go out. I want to write for my own people here. And let's understand that, and let's not be overly critical of the difficulties and sometimes of the compromises that one has to accept in order to tell some of the truth with honesty and in a very important and very useful way. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to put a question to all three panelists, and this is a general question. Are traditional cultures undermining citizens' human rights? Roberto?
Oh, it's a wonderful question. But I don't need 7 minutes. I need many more.
No, you have.
And now she gives me three, probably. You know, I think that cultures,
so natty.
Traditional cultures, are an important part of human development. You know, one of the problems of the contemporary world relates to time. The past is not there, and a project for the future is not there. But if you live only in the present, there is no space. It's like in geometry, a dot. It doesn't have any dimension. You cannot do anything with it, neither morally nor culturally. So you need the past. The problem is when the past becomes a paralysis and prevents you from moving ahead. Usually that doesn't happen naturally, because naturally things evolve. But when somebody takes hold and tries to impose, and here's the political part, and says, this is it, you don't move from here. And this, unfortunately, is especially done by religions and people who run religions and people who tell you, this is so, and you ask, why is it so? And the answer is, God says so. Okay. God hasn't been consulted, usually.
I think Iran's human rights crisis definitely has a political aspect to it, but I think it's a cultural issue as well. You know, it's a very deep cultural thing. I remember I was talking to somebody like a few days ago that, you know, somebody who was tortured inside prison, and, you know, and I was telling that he was asking me, actually it was Maziar, he's here, and what do you think about the entire thing, you know, how people can torture somebody inside prison, you know, and then live their lives. And I told him that when I was like beaten by my interrogator, or when I was during the long interrogation sessions that we had, what I got from the whole thing was that this person see me as the other, and so for him I didn't have any rights. So he was very comfortable doing anything with me, and this me and the other thing in our culture is very deep. We and the others. So for the Iranian government, they are so we are the others, and they are capable of doing anything with the others, intellectuals, dissidents, and anyways, and you know, it's not just the Iranian government. Even in the, you know, amongst among the Iranian people, even you know, me as an Iranian citizen, even we have that kind of. We and the others, and it's deeply rooted in our culture. And I think if we cannot deal with human rights issues in Iran in the long run without addressing these cultural obstacles that have been attached to our culture for a long time, and when I see like in the Western tradition of human rights, that kind of we and the others is much more loose and different. So anyways, I think that definitely that's cultural, and it's not about the Iranian government. If we had a democratic government in place, I think now, still we had Iran, you know, had human rights issues, definitely. And this is something, that's why, you know, we have to work harder, and now we deal with some of the urgent things, like, for example, the arrests, torture, you know, these kind of things. But, you know, in the long run, we have to move deep to address these issues.
Is it cultural?
I believe that you know, traditional culture is not particularly in Iran against human rights standards. It's for all countries, and I guess even in United States, if you do have a referendum about homosexuality, I am sure you cannot predict that 100% of American, they agree with that. So it's not something very particular for Iran. It's for all society. Something that is very important is we can find a kind of democracy. And when we can find a kind of democracy, all opinions, they can show themselves, they can describe themselves, and then we will follow the majority in parliament. Now something that is problem in Iran is the parliament is not a mirror of all society, just a part of people. They do have representatives in the government, in the parliament. And so we cannot stop working for human rights, and we cannot say the reason is traditional culture in Iran, which are against the human rights. I can give you some examples of my experiences in Iran, because as you know, I practiced as lawyer in Iran 22 years in Islamic Republic of Iran. And mostly female who were coming to my office, they had hijab, and sometimes they had very extreme hijab, and they were not following the government, just their hijab was by choice. But when they were talking about their family cases, like divorce, like custody, and some others, when I was explaining that all legal system is Islamic and you do not have absolute rights for having divorce or absolute rights for having custody,
they were asking me who wrote and approved this legal system. And when I was saying that this is coming from clerics and this is according to the Islam principles, they were becoming so angry. And they were saying that if Islam is that, we are not Muslim. And they had very extreme hijab, very extreme Islamic veil. And sometimes they were following government, sometimes not. So we can say for something like adultery, yes, you are right. The society and traditional society is an obstacle for having a part of human rights standards that, you know, cover this issue. But it doesn't mean that Iranian people, they agree with stoning as a punishment. It doesn't. This is matter that government in Iran is behind of either traditional culture of Iranian people. So I guess we don't have a stop our activities for having a better situation, human rights situation in Iran, and working and struggling for having a kind of democracy. I don't know how, and I don't know what time we can get it, but I'm sure we will get it because of the rate of educated people in Iran.
Omid, you mentioned in your opening remarks that there was a love letters were written from outside prison by women, mostly to their husbands, and this love letter exchange was between the wives of the leaders of the reformist movement, as I recall, and I collected them, but. Wasn't this a break with our culture that you do not express these intimate feelings, you know, openly in an open letter addressed to the community? Basically, you're addressing your husband, but this is an open letter. And talking about very intimate issues like, I look at the moon and I miss you at night, or this kind of, yeah, I miss your kisses. And these are traditional people who, as Mehri said, probably observe the hijab because they are believers and so on. But they use this, do you think they use this vehicle of writing open letters in order to attract the attention of the people to the violation of human rights of their spouses in prison?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think it's not just reformist leaders. Bahar Hedayat has written a few letters, and you know,
exactly.
We have seen a lot of exchanges. So over the past three decades, you know, the Iranian government has tried to establish to make dominant a number of narratives when it comes to relationship between men and women. The narrative, the dominant narrative exposed by the government in public spheres, is not to talk about your feelings. People do not talk about it. But now they openly talk about their deepest feelings, and between the lines, they express how they are frustrated by the situation and their condition and all that. So overall, I think a big picture, what they do is to challenge the government's narrative, challenge that kind of narrative that the government has spent a lot of money on that via a number of institutions over the past three decades. And that's, I think, very important, to challenge the government's narrative, to humanize the situation and to give voice. So because for many people, human rights is it's not an issue, for sure, in Iran. But when you hear that somebody is talking, but Iranians are emotional and to some extent romantic, if that's a plus, and that attracts the attention of other groups. So they penetrate different layers of society by doing that. So I think it's a very like innovative way of spreading out the message.
Roberto, is this sacrificing culture for the sake of human rights?
No. You know, before Omid said something very interesting, that the regime, all regimes, try to make the opponent or even the dissident as other. The moment when this other reveals the depth of human, not political, but human feelings, then it becomes more difficult for the regime to represent this other person as an alien subject, as somebody who is maneuvered by the Mossad or whatever. He's a human being who speaks and thinks and feels like you. And this weakens very much the possibility of, you know, expelling the dissidents from the community of normal people.
You want to add something to this?
Yeah, just I would like to talk to audience that something that is very problematic in Iran is all ordinary aspects of social lives and individual lives, all are political according to this political system. And that's the reason we sometimes mix political and social and something that is not political, but there is punishment for that. And they do that under the name of Islam. I'm not sure that's Islam. I'm not expert in Islam, but I guess a religion cannot you know, work in all aspects of a human being. And if they do that, they cannot stay for more than 1,000 years. So they are using and abusing some interpretation of Islam for having more power. And I believe that all ordinary aspects of lives in Iran now means very political. And ordinary people in Iran, and they are in struggle with this kind of government. And I would like say that something that the people are very sad with that is the lack of freedom, social freedom, and not just political freedom. Because for political freedom, a minority like us, we are in trouble with that. But the majority of people, they like to continue their life and very normal life, and they cannot do that. So the lack of social freedoms is something that we were not facing with that during Shah, before Islamic Revolution. And that's the reason now young people, young generation, they criticize their parents that why you did do revolution in Iran, because we can see the film and the reports from before revolution, and we can understand that you did have social freedoms. And I guess in some society like Iran, the first thing that now young generations, all classes of Iranian people, they are working for that is social freedoms more than political freedom.
Can I add something to this?
Sure. Well, both of you can add to it. Go ahead.
Like over the past, I'm just going to say how the trends I mentioned, how it has affected not only like the Iranian people, but even the Iranian authorities. For example, last year I was in Geneva during the Human Rights Council, and as usual, I just go approach the Iranian delegation, and I talked to a number of them during the session, and I could see that how the change has come even to the Iranian authorities. Some of them behind doors, or you know, not on the record, but they sympathize with what was happening. And during the session, I remember that none of the Iranian diplomats were sitting behind their chairs. So it was like they were just walking all around the hall, and it was like they were embarrassed to sit down there and listening to what was happening. And I heard from one of the delegation members that there were some forces within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs that they didn't really put that much effort to have a better response to the council's questions. And it was like that some people actually liked the fact that Iran's case goes to the council and get a resolution being passed by the council. So, I can see how it has changed even part of the government. And however, I believe in general that the Iranian government is not a black and white it's not black and white. And in many cases, we have seen there are elements within the judiciary, there are elements within the establishment that they really want to help. Because of the dominance of a minority from the intelligence, they are incapable of doing anything. But I just wanted to share that the waves of change, has affected the layers of the Iranian authorities as well.
Roberto. What Marian Giscard is very important, but also at the same time very problematic. If it is true that there is a demand for political freedom, which is felt by an elite, and a demand for social, cultural, lifestyle, especially on the part of the, that's felt by non-elite, then there you have the political problem of the opposition in Iran. I think that what we have to do is to prove the truth, which is if you don't have political freedom, if you have political freedom, then also the other freedoms are precarious and they're not really something that you can count on. And it's very, very dangerous because today in China, the Chinese government doesn't bother people about the way they walk around in the street or even the books they read, They don't care. But still, they maintain a stronghold on the politics. So I think whoever wants a future for Iran, a free Iran, a democratic Iran, an Iran as a normal international subject, will have not to give up on this, and we'll have to work on establishing the links which exist between political freedoms and even lifestyle. Otherwise, the regime, sooner or later, will understand, and it's already understanding now. Ahmadinejad is not particularly focused on hijab, okay? And even the subliminal message is, these priests will bother you, I will not. But that doesn't mean he's a Democrat. So let's be very, very careful not to allow the regime to brand people who want political freedoms as elite and people who do not care about the concerns of common people. Again, go back to films. Go to Crimson Gold by Panahi. Go to the Separation. You see the social split, and the regime thrives on this social split.
I think there's a difference between China and Iran in that regard, that in Iran, any changes in Iran, in lifestyle is a political statement. In Iran, we have like the issue of hijab. It's not just a lifestyle thing. It's one of the identities of the Islamic Republic.
Identity.
So if we have some, if we change that, if we see a kind of change in that department, then there is something happening in the political part as well.
Isn't hijab the problem of choice? And that takes you to the basic human rights of the citizen.
Yes.
I mean that. Okay, let me now open the floor to the question. Bill Royce, in the back. Just wait for the mic and...
I enjoyed the panel very much.
Is the mic working? Can you hear him?
Okay.
They
before
can't
I ask
hear
my
you.
Question,
sure.
I just want to say that I think the best testimony to the warmth and strength of Siamak Purzan are his wife and daughter who spoke here. Mm-hmm. Okay? With that, I have a question. I was very relieved to hear from Mr. Mamarian that things are easing up on attitudes toward the Baha'is and gay populations. But my real question is, can you hear me? You don't look as if
I do hear you, yes.
You hear
him? Yes.
You can hear me, okay.
Of course.
My concern is, and I think it's hopeful, that these changes are more generational than anything else. As time goes by, as the old-timers who have all these hatreds of Baha'is die off, and new people come in and can't quite understand the stigma that things are going to get better. Is there hope with generational change for an easing of human rights in Iran?
I totally agree with you. I think there are a number of elements that contribute to these changes. One of them definitely is generational. One of them is changes we have in the communication technologies, for sure. But the fact that we have the internet and we have the social networking websites, we have people can create content. The fact that we didn't know about Baha'is a lot in Iran because there was no forum to talk about this issue. There was no forum for those who were under pressure in Iran to talk about it. Now, many of them, record videos, and there are human rights organizations report on them, and they are present in international forums, and the news about them, is all over the place. So then, my mom and dad, they have to listen. They hear that, so they listen to Voice of America. They might watch two hours of entertainment, but half an hour of news, and they hear about that, and it comes to their conscience. And that issue, I think generational is definitely, and there are many factors involved in this, and that's why I'm so positive about moving from that place.
Mehri, you want to add something?
Just I like add something to this this dialogue, because Dr. Rice, when Muslim Iranian people outside the country, because inside the country it's not possible, as you know. Talking about Baha'i people is a very dangerous taboo in Iran, inside Iran. But when Muslim people, Iranian Muslim people outside Iran, they started to support human rights of Baha'i people, it was very beneficial, I guess. Because, as you know, a very grand Ayatollah Muntazeri, had a very positive reaction on that. And he issued a very important fatwa, and it was the first time a Shia grand Ayatollah issued a fatwa about Baha'i people. It was the first time. And I think that's a very important positive result of this dialogue, and it would be effective and works for the future of Baha'is who are living in Muslim country. He said that Baha'is people has haqqi abu gil, and it means citizen rights. And this is the first time a Shia, a grand Ayatollah in Shia, he talked about citizen rights for Baha'i people. And this is the result that we honor God it.
Yes, please. Okay. Just wait for the mic, please.
I'm Farhad Mehdiyev, coming from Azerbaijan. This is a neighboring country to Iran. And my question about the cultural rights of minorities. As we know, the cultural rights is a part of human rights, of course. But during Shah times and after revolution, Islamic revolution, for the Azeris in Iran, they don't have, they own newspapers, they don't have their own schools. Do you think that if the regime will change in Iran, let's say in 5 or 10 years, will Azeris, will be granted the right to have their own education on their own language or have their own newspaper and media and so on? Thank you very much.
Can I add?
Let me go and then. Go ahead.
Yeah. Right now, during these, I cannot say during these 33 years, because it was not possible talking and criticizing the government for a long term. But these 20 years, I guess all human rights activists, particularly since reform, since 1997, in Iran, this dialogue was opened. And human rights activists, they were talking since 1997. about cultural rights according to human rights for minorities in Iran, like Kurdistan and like some other part of country who their original language is not Farsi. And now human rights activists, they are working for them, and they do have their human rights activists among themselves, but unfortunately they are at risk like all human rights activists inside Iran. So you are right, and we cannot get a kind of democracy country in future if Iranian people and Iranian government, they don't give some other part of Iranian the rights for having the language at the school and the newspaper in their language. Without that, democracy is not possible. But we are not happy with something like divided Iran. We like having human rights in Iran and respectful human rights.
Roberto?
Well, you know, Iran, Persia was an empire. And this reflects in the ethnic composition of the country. But at the same time, is a nation state. Now, there is a tension between nation state, which wants to be homogeneous, ideologically, all nation states, not just Iran, and the reality, which comes from history. How can you balance these two dimensions? Only with democracy and with change. It seems to me very significant that areas of minority ethnic composition were overwhelmingly in Iranian elections for the reformists. This means that they know that only reform, a reformist approach to the handling of power in Iran, can allow for the necessary spaces for their cultural autonomy. In Italy, we had in northern Italy, in the German-speaking area, a very difficult situation. In the 60s, we even had terrorism. And some people there wanted to split from Italy and join Austria. The solution was language freedom, administrative autonomy, a lot of money. And now, of course, there is Europe, so that the border is still where it was, but doesn't mean much. We should make borders, not change borders, which means war, but make borders insignificant. Same thing should be done in Kashmir, for instance. You don't change the borders. Now, the problem is that now, with this globalization, which has created a loss of identity and loss of power, people rediscover their identities and they become micro-nationalists. And a micro-nationalist is even worse than a macro-nationalist. They usually, when they gain their own independence, they start persecuting the little minorities that are inside. It happens in the Caucasus, it happens in Eastern Europe. So let's be very careful. Let's not just fall in love with all separatist causes. The best solution would be claim your rights, obtain your rights with some sort of federal system, autonomy system. We don't care. But moving from that to having your own angry and nasty and nationalistic little country is not a solution.
The discussion about ethnic minorities in Iran, even within this, the Iranian government, is a very live discussion. I remember that during the Khatami's era, the Ministry of Interior did a very an extensive research on this, and the result was very interesting. That for the stability of the political stability of the country, we have to give more freedom to ethnic minorities and religious minorities, and to fund them, as you mentioned, and to develop these provinces. But it's not coming from the Islamic Republic. Even during the Shah, the main perception about like Kurdistan and the other provinces, neighboring the border provinces, was to keep them underdeveloped. That was a major policy that was in place. And there is this conversation was actually, I'm not sure about the Ahmadinejad's era, but it was live during Khatami's era. So there were some people who said, you know, we have to give them freedom. There should be ways to let them practice whatever to speak their language, have their newspapers, and all that. And there was a force within the Ministry of Interior and other departments that they were against that. But I think if we had that kind of environment, like the government that is committed to democracy or to some sort of democracy, then those kind of arguments and discussions will rise to the surface, and I think it's not far, in my mind, it's not far from happening.
Machina? Yes, here. And then. Everybody.
Thank you very much. I'm Mushira Khattab, a visiting scholar with the Woodrow Wilson, and I come from Egypt. And this discussion has been very enlightening for us, for the phase that Egypt is going through now. In Egypt, we have a huge cinema industry. They call it the Hollywood of the East. Many of the people working in this industry have declared that they're planning to leave the country now with the advent of the Islamists. What advice would you give to people in this sector, the cinema sector? God. And I think you would also, because really there is a scare right now for the people working in the cinema industry. Thank you.
Sorry, I mean, because
I had been in your country a few months ago, and before Ikhwan al-Muslimin won, that
Salafis, not only Ikhwan and Salafis.
And Salafis. Yeah, you're right. And now perhaps they join each other. And that time it was during that the last Friday before Ramadan. And it was the first time Islamic people, Islamic political Islamic people, they monopolized Tahrir Square that time, and their voices were purely Islamic and nothing else. It was the first time, and the time I became scared in your country, and I remembered our revolution in Iran, and I became so sad. And when I was talking to very intellectual people in Egypt about this danger that I could see that is coming, all of them, they were saying, no, you cannot understand this society, this is different. And when I insisted that, no, this is not different, why you don't use our experiences, they were saying, no, you are Shia, we are not Shia. Yeah, that was all. I went back to United States, and I was following the news. And when I saw something that I predicted, I became so sorry, and I was going to some very important Muslim scholars in some think tank, and I said that you can work now for the region, except Iran, and why there is not exchanged our experiences, why they don't know anything about Islamic constitution of Iran. Why they don't know anything about Islamic penal code of Iran. And all think tanks, they didn't care about it. And I don't know why. Because they believe that if the people, they want something like Islamic government, doesn't matter, they can get it. So that's...
The artificial division between Sunni and Shia, it's the other.
I'm
sorry,
you cannot.
No, it's very minority. Sunni is very, Shia is very minority in the Egypt. And this minority, they do not have any mosque in Cairo, like Iran in Tehran. Sunni people, they don't have mosque in Tehran. It's very similar. It's very similar. So if we had some opportunity to exchange our experiences, now I guess the region was not like this, because half of population of this region are female. And if they knew that, what kind of lives, you know, Iranian people, Iranian women, now they are under pressure by the name of Islam, they were not following the situation and they were not voting them. But as you know, there is not any political party and organization except Ikhwan al-Muslimin and then Salafists, who they are helping Ikhwan al-Muslimin in Egypt. And something that you know, we suffer of that is lack of democracy and the history of dictatorship in this region. And you are right, it's dangerous, and perhaps you lose something like national income, because in this country, I guess this country is not very attractive for tourists, and your income is coming from tourists. I'm so sorry for that, but hopefully Egyptian people, by democracy, you know, they threw them far from the center of government if they will work against the human rights and women's rights in Egypt.
Roberto.
Yes. I wish I could say something very positive. And I am positive and optimistic in the longer run, but it's going to be tough. Why is it going to be tough? I think it's not a problem of democracy if we define democracy correctly. It is true that in spite of what we had thought, because we had seen the young people, you know, the people, the bloggers, we made a mistake in assessing the social forces at play. Democracy means an Islamist majority. What we don't have there is pluralism, is liberalism. So democracy by itself, meaning majority rule, is not by itself a guarantee. But can you love secularism more than democracy? In that case, you have to be for a dictatorship, like Turkey was for many, many years. Keep them down, because they are not pluralistic. They will impose their own. This is very delicate, and you know the debate is there all over the area. I don't think that choosing pluralism over democracy, meaning imposing freedom, in quotation, but that's what it is a solution. The only solution, well, you know, I come from a Catholic country, and the Catholic Church didn't accept democracy and pluralism just like that. It's quite a recent phenomenon, as history goes. The only hope is that people, since young people know what they want, they have their, in spite of the religious traditions and pressure and power, they will learn, and they are learning already, incidentally, also in Egypt. I don't see many other alternatives.
If there is another question, I'll take two questions and then we'll put an end to the session. The lady here. Yes, please.
Thank you. Maryam Memar Sadiqi. I wanted to express my respect for Mr. Siomak Puzan, first of all, and his dear family. We run Tavana, which is an e-learning institute for Iranian civil society. And this conversation today, this morning's conversation, comes up often in our virtual classrooms with students from inside Iran. It's a very popular, if you will, topic right now in Iranian civil society, you know, the role of culture versus the role of politics. I just wanted to insert into the discussion that there's an important piece of this that hasn't been discussed so far, and that is education and the education system and its impact on the development or the hindrance of culture. As we talk about the improvements or the positive developments culturally, we shouldn't forget that looking at the education system, things are getting worse. They're getting significantly worse, and not just in the universities and academic freedom and crushing of student movement, at the universities, but from, you know, kindergarten through 12th grade, the curriculum is changing. The infringements on girls' freedom inside schools is changing. The insistence on a very militaristic attitude towards outsiders, particularly Israel and the United States, is changing for the worse. All of this is happening while we discuss all these positive developments in culture. So we shouldn't forget the impact of this curriculum and the repression in the universities on the long-term development of Iranian children.
Okay. Just let me answer quickly your question. We have two more panels. And the problem of education will be tackled probably in the next panel when we deal with media. So I think we are just the lady had. Did you have a question? I saw you raise your
yes.
hand. Let's take
the mic and then. The woman who just said something maybe negated what I was thinking. But my name is Margot Zimmerman. And as an outsider, I just wanted to take the opportunity to ask the panel, as someone who gets her news about Iran from newspapers still, mm-hmm. Why is it that the Arabs, and I know, or what I read at least, is that Iranian...
very brief,
yeah,
short.
Okay, that Iranian education is much better now than it was a long time ago, that the middle class is growing, that women have more jobs. And I'm just wondering why the Arab Spring in Egypt and in Yemen, Libya, other places, seems to carry on, whereas the Aryan Spring, if you will, in Iran seems, you know, it's gone. We don't hear anything. And I just want the opinion of you people as experts as why this isn't happening. Because I always think with improved education, you're going to get more people who are going to stay in the forefront.
Okay. Can I Suzanne and Karim, am I right you will tackle the problem of education in one of the two panels?
But this is a wider question.
Yeah. 30 seconds each of you to answer this question, and we'll stop.
You know, the regime in Iran is stronger because it's not just a dictatorship. It's an oligarchy, which has occupied several. It's more flexible. You can get rid of Ahmadinejad, and you're still there as a regime, first. Second, the social dimension. People went to the streets in Iran saying, where is my vote? In Egypt, they were saying, where is my bread? Where are my rights? It was wider, and it was socially wider, much wider. And this is a problem for the Iranian opposition. And I think that events in the Arab world were easier but more superficial. When things will change in Iran, it will be more difficult to change, but it will be more substantial.
When I look at the Arab Spring and the experience that Egyptians are going through, I think we Iranians are three decades ahead of a number of countries in the region. Because three decades ago, we experienced how mixing religion and politics work and how when it's in place, you know, how it functions. So in 2008, Iranians, the experience of a revolution. And we knew that, you know, if you have a revolution and, you know, you don't know what happens afterwards. So I think they were more cautious. It was more mature. As you mentioned, it was just about my worth, which is a very, like, clear, specified demand. And so it was not anything about a revolution. At some point, it turned to some other directions. But in general, it was about the election. And I think the fact that we Iranians are not the political forces in Iran, civil society forces, political dissidents, they are careful and cautious is because of the experience we had during the revolution and how you rise and you overthrow a regime and in that chaotic environment, one group, comes and hijack the entire thing. And so that kind of a sad experience, I think that was one of the things that we had in mind. It was, you know, subconscious.
Just I can say that the history of a struggle for democracy or something is very different between Iran and our other part of the region. And that's why everything is different. And as Omid said, something that happened in Iran was different. They were saying, where are our vote? And they were not saying and asking for regime change in Iran or something like that. And the language of Iranian is Farsi. The language of other region is Arabic. And Iran is a Shia society and Muslim society, and others mostly are Sunni. And everything is very different. It's not true that they are very similar with each other.
That brings us to the end of this panel. Suzanne started her presentation with saying that she brings greetings from her sister Azadeh. Azadeh is a friend of a lot of us in this room. We do miss her. But I took a picture of you and I already emailed it to her. So she thank you very much, and we finished on that.